I'm Rob Vance, and this week I'm in the chair for Polling Matters. Once again, I'm joined by Kieran Pedley.
Hello.
And Chris Hanratty.
Hello.
Chris is a reader in politics at the University of East Anglia, BBC Newsnight's election expert, and one third of the excellent electionforecast.co.uk team. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks.
So this week's is going to be a two-parter, as there's so much to cover. Chris is an expert in using sophisticated political models that take into account polling data and other things, but is also, when on other days, an expert on Italian politics and fluent in Italian. So we're going to try and focus on both of those things and think it's worthy to make it two parts. So, Chris, we've discussed a lot on this podcast how this is one of the most difficult elections for pollsters. What's your view? Why is that? And how does your modelling work seek to address some of those challenges?
So, first thing, this is going to be a really difficult election to predict.
Get the excuses in early, eh?
It's important to say that, just so that I can cover myself if these predictions turn out to be horrendously inaccurate. But I guess you probably wanted a bit more than that, maybe some suggestion of why it's going to be difficult to predict. I guess the most obvious fact is that for a long time we've been able to get by assuming that there's this mythical beast called uniform national swing. And if a party goes up by 5% nationwide, it goes up by that same amount in each constituency. And for a variety of reasons, but the SNP and UKIP in particular, that uniform national swing story isn't going to work so well. So you're going to see different swings, not just in Scotland compared to the rest of the country, but also maybe a very different swing in the east of England, an area around the coast, compared to other parts of England. So my main concern is getting that swing in each constituency right. And I think that's really hard, independently of all the reasons that make polling for this election really difficult.
So Kieran, you've tried to call many a horse race before and have done this kind of work. What's your view? Is the UNS the key thing here, or are there other things, some of those other things that Chris was referencing there, that make this particularly difficult for the polling experts?
I mean, the swing is king, as they say. I mean, obviously that's going to be what determines how we model this election, how many seats are taken in different areas, as Chris says. I think from a polling perspective, which is where a lot of the modelling and forecasting comes into play, there are a number of other factors that are really important as well. We all know about 1992, which was the sort of famous election that the pollsters got wrong. And I would say that I think this election is probably the first one since then where that could happen again. I'm not predicting that it will, but I think it could. Obviously, you know, as we've talked about before, a lot of work has gone in from the pollsters since then to try and make sure that, for example, samples are politically representative, to make sure that you're getting the right balance of Labour, Conservative and so on. And one example of why this is quite difficult for pollsters at the moment is that ultimately, to get a politically representative sample, you have to have some sense of, you know, or people at least have to have some sense of what their political identity is. And I think we're seeing that in a great state of flux at the moment. You know, can you weight a sample, for example, in a nationally representative poll back to being politically representative when huge chunks of the population now say they identify with UKIP? So, on the one hand, you know, yes, we've alluded to, there is, you know, getting calling the SNP and UKIP right is absolutely fundamental. But, you know, the traditional identities or levels of identity with those parties is changing. And that's before we even look at some of the more nuanced and sort of methodological considerations to do with, you know, phone polls used to be more accurate than online polls, at least in election times or general elections. Is that still going to be the case as online panels become more and more sophisticated? And we don't necessarily know. And then I guess finally, but you know, not necessarily exclusively, what about how questions are asked? I mean, a lot of people that read the polls don't necessarily pay too much attention, as you might expect, to the question wording and how things are done. But there's a big debate about how, do we prompt? Which parties do we prompt for? And by this we mean, to those that are perhaps less familiar, typically you've said, okay, would you vote Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat or other? And there's a huge debate about whether that's the right way of doing things. Some pollsters prompt now for UKIP within that band of three. Some don't. But then once we put UKIP in there, because now they're considered to be a major party, do we also put the Greens in? What do we do in Scotland and Wales? I mean, traditionally we do factor in the Nationalists as well. So I guess to bring
it's like the BBC debate problem all over again, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a whole host of reasons, I think, there, and they're just some of them. Why, you know, a point here or a point there in such a close election could be really, really important. Because just from a purely national vote share, it's going to be quite difficult. And then obviously when you come down to Chris's level, I don't envy Chris and people that are trying to do this, because, you know, when you get to that local level, what are you going to do?
So I think that there are loads of things there. I think it would be interesting perhaps in the first instance, given that polling data forms a big part, though perhaps we can come on and talk about whether it's the only part of some of the work that you're doing, Chris. But just on those points about sort of methodologies or house effects, different ways of asking questions and so on, is that accounted for in the model, and how do you go about doing that kind of aspect?
We're big consumers of polling, if you like. So one or other of us, one of the different people involved in the team, typically Jack Blumenau, who's a PhD student at LSE, has the really fun job of taking the numbers from the different PDFs that the polling companies release. And I think it's quite surprising for people who aren't used to consuming polling on a regular basis to see not just the headline figures reported in these PDFs, but six different tables with different combinations of weightings and adjustments. So we'll be big consumers of that polling, as I mentioned, and we'll often take the numbers with certain adjustments applied, but not others. For example, we wouldn't take the numbers which involve a heavy reallocation of don't knows to deal with different factors like the spiral of silence, the tendency of some, let's say, Lib Dem voters to experience a bit of cognitive dissonance dealing with the fact that they voted with a party which is now very unpopular.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if you ask people for their 2010 vote, you get half as many people admitting to voting Lib Dem in 2010. I mean, is that an effect that you control for in the model, or is that something that you, in a sense, take from the pollsters, the readjustments that they already make?
So we exclude some of those readjustments, but we do include others like waiting for propensity to vote or turnout indication.
Okay.
So we're in a kind of halfway house position. I think where that does come in is that we're not just interested in taking the polls as they stand, but also extrapolating to what will happen on the day of the election. And here is one of the kind of technical features of our model. It's this tendency of the swings to regress towards the mean. So what that means is, let's take today's polls, and let's think not about the Conservative and the Labour vote shares in absolute terms, but in terms of what the polls suggest will be the swing compared to last time around. So the Conservatives might be 5% percentage points down on where they were in 2010. Based on previous elections, we know that we should be a little bit sceptical about that. We might want to discount it a little. So at the moment, we would discount that implied swing by about two-thirds. So we take that 5%, 4%, whatever it is, and that becomes a swing of 3 or 4%. For the Lib Dems, that means that we discount the currently atrocious implied swing at the moment. So that means that
it's an implied recovery.
They will recover some of what they've lost. Now, maybe that's through shy voters finally fessing up. Maybe that's through a genuine process of opinion change. But we assume some of that in our model.
And what's that based on? Is that a sort of an observation that's UK-based or from a wider literature about mean revision? I mean, I know that mean revision is something that happens in all sorts of phenomena, but sort of what's the basis on which that sort of assumption is being made?
Yeah, it is a phenomenon which is found in a variety of systems. I think one of the problems with testing this hypothesis assumption across different systems is it's quite often to collect polling data for lots of countries over lots of elections.
Right, right.
But people have collected polling data for a range of countries, and you'd usually think that Britain, with a relatively stable party system, would be a good test case because people have formed particular allegiances to parties. And we might expect those to display predictable shifts in the run-in to an election. So Britain demonstrates this phenomenon and usually has exemplified it to a considerable degree.
I suppose one way of articulating that thing is the sort of unpopularity of a government midterm and then a recovery towards the election in the majority of recent elections.
And you can riff on this on lots of different ways. So there are a couple of other forecasting teams out there which also build in a tendency for governing parties to gain more of what they lost over and above this mean reversion. And you can also have some party-specific effects if you want to make it nice and complicated. So there are variations on this theme, but it's a motif which is present in lots of models.
So we've talked a bit about the polling data that goes into the model then. I mean, are there other things that are going there? I mean, I know that Nate Silver, for instance, made a big song and dance about the fact that the economic approval numbers or raw economic data was going into his model as a way of predicting whether swing states like Ohio were going to move in response to the economy as much as, you know, the sort of other aspects that we have in polling. So do you include any of that kind of data in your model?
So where the extra data comes in is more in modelling things that are at the constituency level rather than the national level. In terms of what we're doing at the national level, we're just working from the polls and this historical tendency towards mean regression. There have been a couple of papers which have looked at the value of economic indicators as a lead indicator a couple of months out from the election in different countries. And interestingly, although in Germany and in the Netherlands, economic indicators do have some value added in predicting the outcome, in Britain we seem to price that in already into the opinion polls.
Right.
So nationally, although the narrative of this 5 years of government fits, really big Labour leads in the middle of the parliament when the economy was going through a couple of quarters of negative growth. Although the narrative fits, generally, it's not that useful at the national level.
Right.
Turn to the constituency level, and all these other factors can become interesting. So you can start looking at things like the annual survey of hours and earnings, parliamentary constituency-based stats on earnings.
I bet. So you have the fun of going through the ONS website to get all that information.
I have suffered along with many others. Yes.
A good friend of mine once observed that he'd be out of a job if anyone ever fixed the ONS survey website tool. So I think, there are many of us who've suffered through that.
We've had a double whammy of pain because not only do we want these other auxiliary characteristics of constituencies, we've also been getting some raw data that we've been reweighting based on census characteristics of constituencies. And whilst you would expect the census to be nationally delivered, nationally administered, to get census characteristics, you need to go not just to the general census authorities, but also to the Scottish census authorities and deal with
the census is a devolved matter, is it?
There are certain questions which are posed in Scotland, but not, as far as I understand it, in England and Wales. This is before we even talk about Northern Ireland.
Yes, perhaps Northern Ireland might well be, I think, an episode all in itself. So is that something so that extra data, pollsters are using that data as well, right? I mean, so you would be looking at updated census data for different age breaks and so on and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, the British election study has often been very useful. Go back to that discussion earlier about making something politically representative. That's always been something that I think I might be wrong, but I think populists do sort of weight back to party identification from that, or at least have done historically. That may have changed recently.
And YouGov used newspaper identification as a similar proxy of sorts.
Yeah,
right?
it's all about I think ultimately the added. I mean, so many people listening to this will know this already, but the added element of political polling versus just nationally representative sample is that political representativeness of a particular sample. So there are a number of different sort of factors that you can bring in. Newspaper readership is one of them. Party identification is another. Past vote recall is another. But of course, the further away you get from a previous election, obviously the less and less reliable that is. But I guess it comes back to that age old thing that polling is a science, but it's also an art as well, because you're trying to judge what you think people mean versus what they say.
And so, what from so if you were to be doing this model again in a year's time, or the sort of outputs from it, I think you mentioned earlier that one of the interesting places where universal swing wasn't happening, or was most obviously not happening, were coastal towns. Yeah. I think someone once observed that UKIP did very well in towns with piers in them, or former cities,
good fish and chips.
Former seaside towns, good fish and chips. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, are there questions that, in a sense, you wish that you had as cross breaks in the polling data that would be particularly useful? Like, it's a place on a coast.
Yeah. We don't actually need that much from the cross breaks. We just need either the subsamples with mm-hmm. the constituency identifier,
okay, yeah,
or constituency polls. So Ashcroft polls, super.
Right.
National polls, if we get the raw data, if it's got a constituency identifier attached, super.
Okay.
We go to work with that. We throw in all this auxiliary data and try and model the patterns that we see in those different subsamples.
So you would take, I mean, so in a poll of 1,000 people, you've got 650-odd constituencies. You're looking to literally cobble together the 5 or 6 that we've got in Clacton this week with this other data set over here for the 6 that we had in Clacton a couple of weeks ago,
exactly,
from a different pollster.
Exactly.
Wow, okay.
So it sounds a lot better if you start with a kind of monthly bundle of data of 30,000 or 40,000.
Yes.
And then you're not onto the on average one respondent per constituency.
Sure.
So our swing there, I imagine.
So we're really sweating this data, but we're trying to give ourselves the best chance by using lots of these other constituency characteristics, things like the past vote in the constituency, earnings, social composition, so things like, does the constituency have a disproportionate number of white voters 55 plus in social grade C2 plus DE who left school without many qualifications, which would be the classic UKIP territory, and which are disproportionately found along the coast, east coast. So we can tap some of that peer effect by feeding in some of these constituency demographic or other characteristics.
Fascinating. And so, I mean, is this putting, as it were, the sort of the household name of pollsters, is this putting them out of business, or do you think that the pollsters themselves are beginning to adopt some of these sort of subtle characteristics more into their thinking?
Well, I think from a polling industry perspective, the modelling's great as a way of looking at what might happen in the future. I suppose that what we need, I mean, in terms of them going out of business, what we need is for people to read the polls in a kind of holistic way, which is obviously partly what the forecasting is doing. But so with pollsters, I mean, let's use Comrades, who I used to work for, as an example. They obviously do the national vote shares very regularly, both online and on the phone. And I think that there's a tendency to say that that's less valuable, not there specifically, but just like the national vote share. But actually, it still does have its value. Because it's quick, it's monthly, it follows the trends. You can see how opinion is shifting in a way that maybe with the less frequently conducted constituency polls, that's harder to read, certainly if you don't have the same batch regularly polled. But at the same time, you know, there are downsides to the national vote share, because ultimately it doesn't tell you a lot of this information about what the Lib Dems doing in the southwest, what's the SNP doing in Scotland, what are UKIP doing in coastal towns. But then to bring it back to the pollsters, I mean, Comrades being an example, they are doing this sort of marginal seats poll that they do quite regularly now, which is quite useful as well. So I think to answer your question, to an extent pollsters are going to have to adapt, or the traditional ones, in terms of what they're producing and the amount of different data they're producing. Another example would be, you know, Mike Smithson from politicalbetting.com is very interested in the swing in England. So we're starting to see a lot of pollsters producing England-only figures.
Right.
I think that they do tend to still be the crossbreak, I think, rather than, you know, particularly English-weighted, which is interesting to see if there's any differences there. So I think they're going to, you know, pollsters are going to have to get cuter about the crossbreaks and subsamples and types of poll that they do. At the same time, I would always defend the national opinion poll as a means of watching the trend. and watching the response to things in a way that, you know, the Ashcross stuff is brilliant, but until that is a monthly thing that does every, that polls every individual constituency you might, not in the country, but everyone you might find interesting that's marginal, it's only going to tell you so much, and it does go out of date very quickly. So, you know, the challenge for us in the industry to sort of understand what is really going on is to take all this information, you know, that's coming at us and trying to decipher into something meaningful.
Great.
So I mean, there must be some huge economic issues in here, because if everyone switches to consuming their polling information through people who aggregate polling, who's going to pay for the polling that ends up being aggregated?
Well, I think that there's the paying for polling thing is a wider issue as well with the media. I mean, ultimately,
this touches on what Lord Fox was talking about a couple of weeks ago, right?
Absolutely. I mean, without betraying any confidences, the media basically don't pay for it. I mean, to all intents and purposes, you know, Rob, you'll know from doing private polling for clients, you know, if you have someone come to you that wants to do a certain poll or survey or research of a project or whatever it is, what a pollster is charging for a media poll versus what you would charge privately for something that's commercial are completely different. So the economics of polling for pollsters is already quite bad. You know, ultimately, it's usually a loss leader, or, you know, I can't speak for every individual pollster, but you know, I don't know what Cobras do now. I was there a long time ago, but you know, it's already something that you're putting out there as a means of promoting your company, as a means of showing your expertise to get these big corporates to pay the real bucks for stuff. So I suppose that it's interesting and maybe a separate discussion on the media and polling in terms of whether that's right or not, because I think that it is important that we've got, you know, really good polling out there that's properly paid for. I suppose the risk is if the media don't pay for it, then people start thinking it's not worth doing.
I mean, it's interesting, in the States, for instance, a lot of universities do polling, you know, have students doing the ringing on from campuses and so on, so you have a number of... So there's a greater sort of ecosystem for polling in the States, and also a hell of a lot more of it. And I wonder if that's something that might well happen over here. Okay, so I think we talked about modelling and polling a lot. I think it's worthwhile coming to the crunch time. So what does the model currently say, Chris? What's the current thinking? And I suppose to the point about a sophisticated conversation about polling and so on, I think what would be really interesting is to know how it's changed over time. So where is it today, and where did it start out? So what movements have you seen since you sort of started the model? What, 6 months, a year ago, is it?
Okay, so at the moment, looking at the version on my laptop hard drive, which was updated from Dropbox recently, we got Conservatives on 284, Labour on 279, SNP on 39, Lib Dems on 25, Greens on 2, UKIP on 1. So any later figures may not resemble that. Always check the website for the latest seat projections. So that's the current forecast.
It's otherwise known as a mess for the country.
I suppose the interesting thing there is, you know, this that has those vote shares are sort of Labour and Conservative on 275 to 290. Is broadly the range that it's been throughout. Is that roughly?
Yeah. In terms of the developments that we've seen over the time that we've been forecasting, and we've been forecasting since about August or September of last year, we've seen two developments. The first is the narrowing of the range around that central messy projection of both parties in 280-something.
Yeah.
So the odds of a hung parliament have crept up steadily.
And is that because the polls have been consistent, or just because you've now got more data to go on and the model becomes more certain over time?
Bit of both. It helps that we're a little bit closer to the election. And obviously over time those projections and the range associated with them will narrow further.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're right, they'll narrow further around our central projection.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're wrong, hopefully the forecast will revise gracefully to reflect that. That's the first development. Second development is something which we think we caught relatively early, and that's the change in the SNP predicted number of seats. And that was something which you could see just about in some of the crosstabs, and you could see in some of the British election study polling, but which people only really reacted to when we got a couple of Scotland-specific polls showing the SNP up in the 40s. And I think Kieran, that links to your earlier point about the value of, well, you described it as cute polling, but these yeah. kind of meso-level polls and not giving a UK-wide picture, but giving a more targeted picture of particular areas. So that's the second big development, and obviously, politically, a really significant one, because it looks very likely that the SNP will be the third largest party, that it would be difficult to form a government without taking their views into some account. It means that some of the benefits for the Lib Dems in terms of short money, parliamentary offices, some of the minutiae of Westminster politics,
by being the fourth party,
the Lib Dems as the fourth party are cut out from some of that.
Right.
So that's the second big development we've seen, but it's been roughly consistent since, let's say, November, December.
So, Kieran, I mean, does that reflect with what you are seeing in things like the Ashcroft poll, the sort of the bigger sort of helicopter view, or perhaps on the ground? I mean, so UKIP on one would presumably be Clacton remaining UKIP, but the Kent seat switching back to presumably the Tories. Greens on two would be, I would guess, holding Brighton Pavilion and maybe taking Bristol West. The Lib Dems on 25, I mean, does the Lib Dems on 25 sort of ring true with your perception?
The Lib Dems, I think, are the one that I struggle with the most, actually, because there is this perception that they want the general election to be their national version of the Eastleigh by-election, don't they, where actually the national vote share is collapsing, but we managed to hold on where we are because we've got strong local sort of candidates there and that sort of thing, and we're just going to put all our eggs in that basket of defence, basically, which is, it makes absolute sense. I mean, the UKIP one is surprising. To an extent, I mean, I think that if there was one UKIP MP, it's going to be Douglas Carswell, isn't it? I suppose Mark Reckless's position is more questionable. I mean, the Ashcroft polling around his direct seat has been more ambiguous, I think, at times. Nigel Farage is an interesting one, because, and we're going to see a lot of Thanet South, isn't it? Yeah. We're going to see a lot of that polled. I'd be surprised if he doesn't manage to pull it off when it comes to it. I mean, this is a slightly different debate to specifically forecasting, isn't it? But yeah, and I think that the SNP surge is very obvious from polling from, you know, Ipsos Mori in particular, I think, but also Savation as well, and TNS. You know, there's clearly a surge there.
So presumably 39 seats is somewhat lower than you might get on a, as it were, a uniform swing. 39 would presumably have some mean revision going on. I mean, that's a big increase for the SNP, but not the biggest. That still has Labour with, what, 12, 15,
yeah,
20
if,
seats or something.
If you were doing an election held today now cast, you'd have the SNP on kind of 45, 48
right.
seats.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, that's a big difference. I mean, in an election like this, you know, that those sort of six seats that Labour might well hold on to, you know, building in that idea of a bit of a resurgence. Sorry, Kieran.
No, I was just going to say, I think yeah, no, that is a big difference, and that is certainly music to Jim Murphy's ears, I imagine. There's still a sense, I feel like, it feels like there's still a sense in Scottish Labour that although things are bad, they can still pull it round to be something incredible, but, you know, I might have that wrong. I mean, one of the striking things for me in this election is how vital England is going to be to Ed Miliband. You know, we've spoken on this podcast about Scotland specifically, about Wales specifically, and it seems to be that, you know, Wales and Scotland are either bringing negligible to the table in terms of Wales, or a real, real headache in terms of Scotland. So that means that Ed Miliband's path to Downing Street seems to be in these English marginals. But actually, you know, for various reasons, whether you attribute it to Ed Miliband's leadership is probably slightly generous, but for several reasons, it looks like Labour might actually do quite well in England in some of these marginals, where for various reasons, the collapse of the Lib Dem vote, the rise of UKIP in certain seats, you know, it's all very unpredictable. But, you know, I think that, you know, all I can add to what's already been said is that the election is on a knife edge. It will be interesting to see whether this historic idea of the shy Tory, you know, I think it was Rob Hayward who was talking about polls underestimating the Conservative vote share in this Parliament, does that come to pass and give David Cameron that smidge more in some of these English marginals that means that they can pull ahead 20, 30 seats from Labour? Because it feels to me like, as we know, because of the nature of this of the Conservatives in Parliament, I don't think it's good enough for them to be a handful of seats ahead of Labour to form a government. It feels to me like they need to be sort of 20, 30 seats ahead, roughly, picking figures out. And that way they can renew their vows with the Lib Dems, potentially, you know, with all the caveats of how difficult that might be, and maybe get the DUP in there as well. That feels like the way David Cameron wins, which is a much smaller target to hit, I think, than Miliband and Labour, even though actually, I think we've discussed before, forming some sort of agreement with the SNP is maybe sounds easier on paper than it might be in practice.